This is Audible.
Tantor Audio presents Never Trust a Liberal Over Three, Especially a Republican, by Ann Coulter. Narrated by Marguerite Gavin. Chapter 1. Will this be on the midterms? Liberals never give up. Nothing is ever over until they get their way, much like two-year-olds. That's why we have to go back every few years and remind everyone that we already had this argument, and liberals lost. There's a reason our party's symbol is the elephant. We never forget. And the Democrats is a jackass. Hey, anyone remember when liberals told us in the 1970s that Earth was going to freeze in 2 years? Now they tell us it's going to overheat in 2 years. Remember when Hubert Humphrey said he'd eat his hat if civil rights laws ever led to racial quotas? Now they call us racist for opposing racial quotas. Remember when Teddy Kennedy assured us his immigration bill would not alter the country's ethnic mix? Since the bill passed, immigration has changed the nation's ethnicity from nearly 90% white in 1965 to about 63% white in 2013. Remember when they called President Ronald Reagan a dangerous cowboy threatening world peace? Now they act like he was a good partner with liberals in winning the Cold War. Remember when the media howled that President Bush lied in his State of the Union address about Saddam Hussein seeking uranium from Niger? Then two investigative committees, here and in Britain, established that he was telling the truth, and liberal darling Joe Wilson was the liar. If you do remember any of that, then Aaron Sorkin's TV show The Newsroom will make no sense to you. Conservatives win an argument in real life, and then a year later, Sorkin writes a little teleplay reversing the facts so that liberals get to win. Most people barely pay attention to what's happening now, much less 2 years ago, and much, much less a few decades ago. That's how the liberal version of history becomes accepted fact. It's not that history is written by the victors. History is written by the pushy. When one side cares much more about the historical record, there's not a lot you can do about it, especially when the pushy have tenure. I've often said that I could rewrite the same columns every year because liberals keep telling the same lies, but there's a limit to how many times a person can point out that Valerie Plame wasn't an undercover agent. The August 6, 2001 presidential daily briefing titled "Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S." was irrelevant to the 9/11 attacks. Joe McCarthy was right. The teenagers convicted of the attack on the Central Park jogger were guilty. Executed murderer Troy Davis was guilty. Armed citizens reduce crime. Modern science has proved Darwin wrong. Waterboarding as practiced at Guantanamo was never considered a war crime. And so on. One victory. At least Keith Olbermann has stopped telling people he went to an Ivy League school. You think you've finally defeated liberals on some issue, but they're just waiting impatiently to repeat the same thing they said last time. There are entire Hollywood movies about the innocence of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. The left never thought the Soviet Union would fall. When it did collapse and all the proof came tumbling out, establishing that Joe McCarthy was right, and all the liberal martyrs had been Soviet spies, the natural thing would be for them to shut up for the rest of their lives, hunker down, and hope no one brought it up. Au contraire, they never quit. You know what? We're going to make another movie about the horrors of the Red Scare. More astonishing than the range of issues liberals got wrong is the fact that they're the ones who won't let it go. The magnificently successful Iraq War has been rewritten as a failure. The Vietnam War is said to have been unwinnable from the start, and liberals claim Ronald Reagan didn't win the Cold War. It just ended. Or maybe Gorbachev ended it. In any event, Reagan merely continued the policies of his predecessors, just like Rudy Giuliani continued Dinkins's crime policies. The New York Times's treatment of any subject will be the same until the end of time, only more so. Every once in a while, you have to go back and set the record straight. That's what this book does. Liberal pushiness prevails not only in history, but in actual public policy. We vote and vote and vote and vote until they win, and then we never vote again. Or we'll have a big national debate about one of their kooky ideas, The people vote, liberals lose, and they bring a lawsuit to get what they want by judicial decree. Even when we win, we can't win. In California alone, multiple lawsuits were brought to block popular initiatives banning racial quotas at state schools, welfare for illegal aliens, and gay marriage. Liberals got a court to overturn the people's will in all these cases, except the prohibition of racial quotas. But they won't stop trying. A federal appeals court first upheld Proposition 209's ban on race discrimination in college admissions in 1997, 1 year after the initiative passed. In 2012, another lawsuit was brought, again demanding that the same law be overturned, with support from Governor Jerry Brown, who I believe is supposed to defend California's laws. Proposition 187, denying illegal aliens welfare, passed overwhelmingly in California, with the support of 64% of whites, 56% of African Americans, and 31% of Hispanics. This was in the face of a massive PR campaign portraying the proposition as a piece of anti-Hispanic racism. 40% of voters said the only reason they went to the polls that day was to vote on Proposition 187. The reaction of most Californians to the initiative was, "That's not already the law?" Liberal groups instantly challenged the measure in court. 3 days after California voters approved it, a federal judge issued a restraining order to prevent the law's implementation and later declared it unconstitutional. That ruling was being appealed when Democrat Gray Davis was elected governor and dropped the appeal. A law denying welfare to illegal aliens, approved by nearly 60% of California voters, never became law because liberals didn't like it. "I came here illegally, but you know what? I can't make it in this economy. Would you guys mind cutting me a check once a month?" The voters can't stop that. The entire country jawboned gay marriage for a few years after the Massachusetts Supreme Court foisted the issue on us in 2003 by discovering a right to this novel idea in the state constitution, written in 1779 by the very Christian John Adams. Americans responded by adopting constitutional amendments in 31 states explicitly prohibiting gay marriage. Other states banned it by statute. Everywhere gay marriage was put on the ballot, including liberal states like Oregon and California, it lost. One state briefly seemed to approve of gay marriage, Arizona, but that was apparently a mistake because 2 years later the voters overwhelmingly approved a constitutional amendment banning it. The people hadn't started the argument about gay marriage, but they ended it. The public didn't want gay marriage. Or at least the people thought they had ended it. When allowing people to vote resulted in a resounding no, liberals sued and got the courts to give them gay marriage. A few years later, voters in three states finally approved gay marriage. The left's philosophy is, wanting something more than someone else gives us the right to win. When conservatives win a favorable Supreme Court opinion, it's not a backdoor ruling by judges vindicating some nutty theory believed by 20% of the people. And when they bring lawsuits, it's only to enforce real rights, actually mentioned in the Constitution. Conservative court victories tend to confirm public opinion, not upend it. The Supreme Court finally acknowledged the right to bear arms, for example, in the 2008 case, District of Columbia v. Heller. But by then, 39 states had already adopted concealed carry laws. Not only that, but even law professors not inclined to agree with the National Rifle Association, such as Akhil Amar at Yale, Alan Dershowitz at Harvard, and Sanford Levinson at the University of Texas, had concluded that the Second Amendment guaranteed an individual right to bear arms. After all that, the court finally admitted what every serious person already knew. The Constitution grants the people a right to bear arms. But there's no permanent victory on any issue with liberals. Maybe they can't ban guns at the moment, but they'll wait, hoping for a switch in the Supreme Court's membership so they can start grabbing everyone's guns. After the Newtown, Connecticut school shooting at the end of 2012, liberals turned on a dime from vein-popping, angry self-righteousness about guns to sneering at gun rights supporters, "No one wants to take your guns away." Really? Are you sure? Because I think you do. In March 2013, Illinois Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky warned, an assault weapons ban is just the beginning, adding that a complete ban on handguns could be possible through state and local action. In December 2012, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said, confiscation could be an option, mandatory sale to the state could be an option. In a 1995 interview about the so-called assault weapons ban, Senator Dianne Feinstein said, if I could have banned them all, Mr. and Mrs. America, turn in your guns, I would have. Running for president in 1988, Jesse Jackson described his position on gun control to the New York Times, saying, I would struggle to ban them. So maybe it's not just right-wing paranoia that leads people to believe Democrats want to take our guns. In the midst of all these Democratic demands for gun confiscation, on January 11, 2012, MSNBC's Alex Wagner smirked, no one, anywhere, is talking about doing away with the Second Amendment, and no one, anywhere, is advocating stripping away gun ownership. Yes, yes, last month Democrats wanted to take your guns away, but that was a whole month ago. They've learned. It's like the guy who tried to rape you last week getting indignant at you for imagining he wants to rape you this week. You act like I'm trying to rape you. Cuckoo, cuckoo. What? That was a week ago. Except that Jan Schakowsky announced her desire for gun confiscation 2 months after MSNBC's Wagner laughingly assured us, eyes rolling merrily, that no one anywhere is advocating stripping away gun ownership. The question is not, would Democrats like to confiscate our guns? Yes, obviously, that much we know. We can discuss whether they have the power to do it, but don't dare tell us it never crossed their minds. And by the way, it's sort of suspicious when Democrats say, we don't want to ban guns, we just want a list of all the people who own them. That was the position of the Million Mom March in 2000. They demanded licensing of handgun owners and the national registration of all handguns. For liberal ideas to work, it's important that no one remember what happened yesterday. Back in 1967, New York Mayor John V. Lindsay signed a law requiring all long guns to be registered. Everyone swore up and down that the list of gun owners would never be used to take guns away. Then on August 16, 1991, New York City Mayor David Dinkins dusted off Lindsay's list and confiscated all registered rifles and shotguns in the city. Apparently, it was easier to take trap-shooting guns from 70-year-old guys on Sutton Place than to go to the South Bronx and take Saturday night specials off of criminals. And that's what made New York City the fun, crime-free, livable city that it was under Dinkins. Motto, no radio. Crime hasn't been a major political issue for a while, thanks to Republican crime policies. If there's anything you'd think even liberals wouldn't touch, it would be the policing programs that have pushed crime rates to historic lows. Do not relax, listeners. Liberals are dying to get their hands on the levers of power so they can start releasing criminals again. The Democrats' ideas on crime were tested in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s, and the result was mind-boggling crime rates. Countless Americans were murdered, robbed, raped, and left permanently disfigured, and not just by Kennedys. So that liberals could try out ideas dreamed up in all-night college bull sessions. The madness was finally broken in the 1990s, and we saw how quickly crime could drop in places that adopted sane crime policies, especially in New York City under Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Liberals deny the facts right in front of everyone's eyes, insistently claiming that the crime rate actually began to decline under Mayor David Dinkins. That idea is so preposterous. It is repeated nightly on MSNBC. It's like saying, the decline in Jew killing actually began under the Nazis. In fact, the slowdown from 1944 to 1945 was much bigger than from 1945 to 1946. So don't be telling me the Allies did a better job at stopping the Holocaust. That's a calumny against the record of the Führer. Yes, Dinkins did such a phenomenal job running city into the ground during the first 3 years of his administration that By his last year, the crime rate had no place else to go but down his last year. The number of murders fell that year from an astronomical 2,154 to an astronomical 1,995. The first year of the Giuliani administration, crime fell 20% from Dinkins's heroic final year and continued to fall. By his last year in office, there were only 714 murders in the city. By continuing Giuliani's crime policies, Bloomberg has kept the murder rate at historic lows. But as New Yorkers may soon find out, that could change overnight. The few cities hermetically sealed from logic by Democratic leadership, such as Detroit and Chicago, did not share in the nation's bounty of low crime rates. It's probably good to keep these places around as examples for the next time liberals start rolling their eyes and telling us that incarceration doesn't work. And they will. The arguments may change, but the FU arrogance remains the same. Liberals just can't grasp the concept of punishment. Except in the narrow cases of gun ownership, smoking, and hate speech, but never for real crimes like, say, murder. Obama used the excuse of the sequester to release criminal aliens. Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis released Willie Horton. The Ninth Circuit issued 4 stays in a single night in an attempt to stop the execution of child murderer Robert Alton Harris. And 6 justices of the Supreme Court have been trying since 2011 to force California to release 30,000 dangerous criminals from prison to relieve overcrowding. California had no money to build prisons because it had to pay government workers' pensions. To advance their policy agenda, liberals depend on people forgetting. Forget what New York was like under David Dinkins. Forget what the nation was like in the 1970s. Forget the prosperity unleashed by Reagan's tax cuts. Forget that every government program always ends up costing 6,000 times more than Democrats' original estimate. They need you to forget because they plan to bring the same policies back with an extra dollop of self-righteousness next time. Republicans win a big policy victory, it works, and the liberal naysayers are proved wrong. Then Democrats roll it back the next chance they get. In the 1990s, the Republican Congress reformed welfare, and the result was not starving children in the streets, as liberals had predicted, but millions of Americans leaving the welfare rolls and getting jobs. Welfare reform was such a smashing success that Bill Clinton started claiming full credit for it, though he couldn't seem to pass it with a Democratic Congress. But then the Obama administration came in and eviscerated the crucial work requirements of welfare reform. We went right back to the government not worrying about paying able-bodied Americans not to work, and not just Obama. Reagan's tax cuts gave a huge boost to the U.S. economy, as did tax cuts under John F. Kennedy and Calvin Coolidge. So naturally, a perennial item on Democrats' wish list is to raise taxes. You can't win with these people. Facts and evidence are useless. The implementation of left-wing policies is especially impressive when you consider that the Democrats' ideas are both insane and hated by most Americans. I believe the citizenry was reasonably clear about not wanting national health care back in the 1990s, when Bill and Hillary Clinton tried it. The public forced Democrats to abandon their health care bill and then punished them anyway for even thinking about it. The next election produced the first Republican Congress in 40 years. But as soon as Democrats controlled the presidency and both houses of Congress again, item number 1 on the agenda was universal health care. By universal, Democrats meant provided by the government. And by provided by the government, they meant crap that will continually get worse. When have Republicans ever shown the steely-eyed determination of Democrats to rush through a checklist of items the moment they get control of the government? What did Bush get done his first 4 years as president when he had a Republican House and Senate? Reagan implemented nation-saving tax cuts and ended the Soviet Union, but he couldn't even get rid of the Department of Education, created a few years earlier by Jimmy Carter, as a sop to the teachers' unions. The only policy Republicans have ever pushed with the tenacity of a liberal is amnesty for illegal aliens. So we know Republicans are capable of the Democrats' stick-to-itiveness, but only for something most Americans hate. Conservatives, we need to adopt the smart things Democrats do, not the stupid ones. We like their persistence, but not their plans to wreck the country. We like the part about winning elections, not the part about jamming execrable policies down the nation's throat. Democrats do not lose any close elections, and not only because they steal the ones that aren't called on election day. Of the 7 Senate races rated toss-ups by Charlie Cook's political report in 2010, Republicans lost 5 of 7. Out of 10 Senate races rated toss-ups in 2012, Republicans lost 8 of 10. That is not a party overly concerned with its electoral success. Unless Republicans are trying to eliminate themselves as a political party, they've got to stop lunging at easy solutions and imaginary scapegoats. We have to know what keeps going wrong in order to stop it from going wrong again. It's one thing to be hit by lightning, and it's another to stand in an open field holding an iron rod during a lightning storm. Amnesty for illegals is no silver bullet, except to the heart of the Republican Party. The fact that the Democrats need 30 million new voters is just not a good enough reason to legalize 11 million illegal aliens and all their relatives. Nor is the Tea Party or the establishment responsible for our losses. Those are maledictions, not analyses. Though it is the establishment pushing that idiotic idea about amnesty. The Tea Party gets blamed for all the Republican Party's woes, but the problem with those candidates wasn't that they were too budget-cutty. The problem was they were too into musing about rape. In any event, the Tea Party candidates add up to only 4 blown Senate races out of 13 toss-ups the Republicans lost. A third party is not the answer. How do you plan to keep mountebanks out of your third party? 20% of you leapt at Ross Perot as the authentic conservative in 1992. Then his campaign manager turned around and endorsed Bill Clinton. The Republican Party has no natural defense mechanism against charlatans and saboteurs because politics is not what Republicans think about every second. Democrats love government. They spend their lives trying to maneuver themselves into a position to run other people's lives. Republicans don't want careers in government and give little thought to how to get there. Often they run for president only because they hope it will lead to more speaking gigs and TV appearances. That may explain why Republicans seem to attract the sort of candidate who enjoys startling people at cocktail parties with outlandish remarks. There's a great living to be made by appealing to rubes and hotheads. Even if you lose, you'll get a talk show. At that last debate, I was the king of the badasses. That's great. Now 6 Republican congressmen will lose because of you. For the pettiest reasons, ego gratification, revenge, money, some people are perfectly willing to screw over Republicans. Luckily for the Democrats, there's no shortage of left-wing people to put on TV. If a TV producer wants a spokesman for partial birth abortion, he can just ask his wife for one of her friends. To attract the attention of TV bookers, apparently a lot of conservatives think they need to run for president. You have to know you can't win. Yes, but running will increase my speaking fees. With the most influential conservative spokesman in entertainment themselves, there's no one to say, let's keep our eye on the ball. All that matters is beating the Democrats. Cheap shot, grandstandy moves are fun, but lead to landslide losses in actual political campaigns. Republicans can't keep sanctioning these publicity stunts. We need to concentrate on winning elections. What was the point of holding 26 Republican primary debates or forums before the end of February 2012? The hucksters are well served by endless primary debates. The TV networks love them. Conservative talk radio thrives on them. It's great for the Ron Paul's menswear collection at Macy's. You know who 26 debates doesn't help? The Republican Party. And why are any congressmen or businessmen showing up in our presidential primaries? They're never going to get the nomination, so they're just wasting our time and weakening our eventual nominee. In 1988, the Democratic candidates for president were derided as the Seven Dwarves. But even that pathetic lineup consisted of three governors, three senators, and Jesse Jackson. I don't care if it makes you feel good. Conservatives, do not ever, ever consider running a presidential candidate who has not been a senator or preferably a governor. No, not even our beloved Ben Carson. What are we concentrating on? That's right, winning. Conservatives who think, well, it's never happened before, but that doesn't mean it couldn't happen, are as delusional as liberals who think they've finally found a government program that will save money. Passion is great, but in politics what matters is scoring. Getting applause from a small slice of enthusiasts while alienating independents accomplishes nothing. I, too, enjoy those who tick off the right people. I am someone who ticks off the right people. But we're talking about elections. About half of the Republican presidential candidates in the last two election cycles would have inspired every stupid woman in America to drive to the polls sobbing in order to vote against them. I sobbed on the way to the polls when McCain was running, but for a different reason. Anyone who hurts the Democrats' electoral prospects is dead. Not so the Republicans. If John Edwards, Ned Lamont, and Bill Bradley were Republicans, they'd have radio shows, TV gigs, and best-selling books. Whatever happened to Wesley Clark? Where's Mike Gravel? Mike Huckabee has a TV show. If you want to know what the other former Republican presidential candidates are doing these days, just turn on the radio or TV. Democrats rule their base with an iron fist, which is especially impressive when you consider that their base is composed of drama queens and attention seekers who specialize in taking positions that appall most Americans. Wait until the public finds out the CIA is sleep-depriving Al-Qaeda terrorists. Those are their voters. But the Democratic Party operates like an old communist cadre. Single-mindedly focused on winning elections, the Democrats don't run candidates like Henry Waxman or Sheila Jackson Lee for the United States Senate. They don't run abortion zealot Barbara Boxer in Pennsylvania, abrasive New York Senator Chuck Schumer in Montana, or Montana's phony hayseed Brian Schweitzer in New York. Internet lechario Anthony Weiner isn't allowed out of New York City. They keep Patty Murray locked in her office at all times. Democratic candidates who have to get elected in places other than New York invariably project a leave-it-to-beaver normalcy. Running for the U.S. Senate from Arkansas in 2002, for example, Democrat Mark Pryor ran campaign ads showing him reading the Bible and praying at the dinner table with his family. He claimed to be pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, pro-military spending, and pro-Iraq war. Don't let Emily's List know. That's why they win elections. Democrats are perfectly open about their playbook. Republicans could easily steal it. As Democratic Senator John Tester of Montana explained in the pages of the New York Times, you don't put a point guard under the basket and tell him to rebound. So the Democrats run a prototypical fake American like himself in Montana and far-left Barbara Boxer in California. The Times summarized the difference in the parties this way. The Democrats tailor each campaign to the particular candidates and the states they are running in, i.e., they run fake Americans in the red states and crusading self-righteous liberals in the blue states. Whereas Republican candidates tend to ride national waves, running on broad national issues like the size and scope of government, i.e., they give no thought whatsoever to winning elections, but Americans sometimes vote them in anyway. Let's consider just one example of how Republicans lose winnable elections. In four separate Senate races, Republicans were screwed by campaign consultants fleecing deep-pocketed candidates rather than doing the hard work of electing Republicans. I salute anyone who runs for office as a Republican, but Linda McMahon in Connecticut and John Racy in West Virginia were lied to by campaign consultants who told them they had a shot. Racy has lost four statewide elections in conservative West Virginia, including the 2010 and 2012 U.S. Senate elections. Republican whiz kid consultants couldn't learn after the first two. It's great that they can afford Jaguars now, but because of their greed, Republicans gave up 2 Senate seats from a state so conservative that even Democrats have to pretend to love guns and oppose Obamacare. Let me introduce you to Senator Joe Manchin. In a textbook case of Republican malfeasance, Racy was mortally wounded by the National Republican Senatorial Committee's Hickey campaign commercial. The fact that everyone listening to this does not instantly know what I am talking about proves that Republicans do not punish the people who hurt them. In 2010, the NRSC hired a Philadelphia ad agency to produce a TV ad for Racy. Knowing nothing about West Virginia, the Philadelphia firm ended up using actors who were like something out of The Sopranos. Then it leaked that the Republicans' ad agency had requested Hickey actors for the West Virginia ad. Racy's lead evaporated overnight. Why don't we know the names of the moron Republicans who blew West Virginia? Who told Racy he could win? What genius at the NRSC came up with the idea to go to a Philadelphia advertising agency for a West Virginia political campaign? And is his brother-in-law still working there? I promise you, the Obama campaign organization in West Virginia was not being run out of Philadelphia. Republicans should refuse to give money to the party until we have the names of these people and a blood oath that they will never be hired again. Instead, Racy and McMahon's consultants will be probably wrecking the campaigns of 5 new Republican candidates in 2014. No one gets rich by sabotaging the Democratic Party, but a lot of people get rich off losing races for the Republican Party. Those races alone amount to at least 3 and maybe 4 more Senate seats Republicans should have picked up, but lost for no good reason. In West Virginia, Republicans could easily have won twice. In Connecticut, at least once. Add those 3 seats to the races where Republicans had a sudden compulsion to talk about rape during their campaigns. Todd Akin, Richard Murdoch, and Sharon Angle. And a kamikaze candidate in Delaware, Christine O'Donnell, Republicans would have a 53-seat majority in the U.S. Senate. We need to adopt the Democrats' merciless enforcement techniques without the ideology. Is that so hard? Instead, we keep getting all the passion with none of the discipline. Besides putting liberals in a position to run the country, which is always a mistake, the worst thing about these losses is that they allow the media to roll out the old chestnut about social issues being death for Republicans. That claim is disproved by all recent political history. The Defense of Marriage Act passed the U.S. Senate 85-14. It was signed into law by Clinton, who ran campaign commercials claiming all credit for it. How did Bush's privatization of Social Security go? Polls going back to 1996 show that large majorities of Americans oppose abortion after the first trimester, by more than 70% in recent polls. Reagan wasn't hurt even in states like New York and Connecticut for being pro-life. Nor, more recently, was Chris Christie in New Jersey. How's Paul Ryan's reform of entitlements going? In fact, and to the contrary, it was President Bush betraying conservatives that triggered Republicans' latest losing streak. Contrary to liberals' bizarro world alternative history, Americans didn't turn against Bush over the Iraq War. We had won, executed a dictator, presided over democratic elections, and killed loads of Al-Qaeda fighters. How was the Iraq War bothering anyone? The conservative base turned against Bush for his years of big spending, followed by his pushing amnesty for illegal aliens after getting reelected in 2004 with a Republican House and Senate. Why are social conservatives always being told to shut up when their issues are quite popular with voters? The lesson of Todd Akin and the other unfortunate choices is not to stop being conservative. It's to stop being stupid. True, none of these candidates were as stupid as Senator Patty Murray or as gaffe-prone as Vice President Joe Biden. But we're not Democrats. We don't get protected by the media. Any Republican running for office should know that. There are no prizes in politics for caring the most, only for scoring the most. Devotion to the cause isn't better than having a modicum of political savvy. If we're serious about improving the country, We need candidates to be brutally honest about their own appeal. That's if they really care about the team. If they just want to score a few points while their team loses, then we need to call in Luca Brasi. This isn't a game. We aren't picking basketball brackets. Bad things happen when Republicans lose elections and Democrats have veto-proof majorities. After the Goldwater debacle in 1964, we got the full flowering of Lyndon Johnson's pernicious Great Society programs responsible for destroying the black family, and not doing a half-bad job with white families these days either. We got Teddy Kennedy's immigration law banning European immigrants and replacing them with a million immigrants a year from the Third World. After Watergate, we got an off-the-charts left-wing Congress that came just short of outlawing the Republican Party. Among its legislative accomplishments, this overwhelming Democratic Congress systematically dismantled our national intelligence, as Democratic Congressman Ron Dellums vowed to do, brick by brick. Passed egregiously expensive environmental legislation estimated to cost more than $100 billion per year as early as the late 1970s. Established the Legal Services Corporation, which pays lawyers to bring class action lawsuits to increase welfare payments. Slashed defense funding and, for the cherry on top, betrayed our ally, South Vietnam, by refusing to give them arms after the North invaded, resulting in a total communist takeover of Vietnam and Cambodia. A few decades later, Democrats on the 9/11 Commission would be on their high horses, railing about the failure of our intelligence. Huh, I wonder how that happened. It happened when the overwhelmingly left-wing post-Watergate Congress deliberately hamstrung our intelligence agencies in the 1970s over the vigorous protests of Republicans. The country wasn't moving left. This was just a few years after Richard Nixon crushed George McGovern in the 1972 election, and a decade before Reagan won the largest electoral landslide in history. But the media had taken out Nixon with Watergate, allowing far-left liberals to sweep Congress and whip out their dream journals. The reason we have Obamacare is not because the public was clamoring for the federal government to take over health care. It's because the Democrats had 60 senators. They had been waiting around for 50 years to check off the national health care box on their FDR's unfinished business list. Not a single Republican in either the House or Senate voted for it. Nationalizing one-sixth of the economy was passed by one party sneering, "Ha-ha, we have 60 votes." Elections matter. We're trying to make the country a better place. But if our candidates don't win, we can't do that. As the rest of this book shows, life is a horror when liberals are running things. Chapter 2. If Chuck Schumer is smiling, vote nay. And other good advice for conservatives. I have loads of good advice in this chapter. Always get enough sleep, drink plenty of water, and stop losing elections. Here are my tips for elected Republicans. 1. Do not get elected by patriotic middle-class Americans, then get to Washington and start doing the bidding of the media and your rich friends from Wall Street and Silicon Valley by pushing amnesty. 2. With the free time you'll have by not lobbying for amnesty, repeal the campaign finance laws so we can get better candidates than you. The reason we have no Reagans anymore is that Reagan wouldn't run for office today with the fundraising hell required by campaign finance laws. After the 2012 elections, the Democratic Party instructed its freshman congressman to spend 5 hours a day on fundraising, according to the New York Times. That's why the country ends up with narcissistic sociopaths like Marco Rubio and Anthony Weiner. 3. Remember that the non-Fox media, NFM, is your sworn enemy. If they start lavishing you with praise, you have become the enemy of mankind, or worse, John McCain. Here are my tips for Republican voters. 1. No elected Republican will do everything you want. Don't run off and instigate an ugly, rancorous, and expensive primary against an incumbent Republican in order to modestly improve the candidate and very possibly lose the seat. 2. The only exception to tip number 1 is that you must destroy any elected Republican who pretends to be a Republican, but then tries to lose every single issue across the board by giving the Democrats 30 million new voters with amnesty. 3. Learn to rely on facts and don't get swept up in groupthink slogans about establishment Republicans. Otherwise, boy, will your face be red when you realize you were the one fighting for the establishment Republicans. Gingrich, Perry, Santorum, and Paul Ryan, all of whom support amnesty. Bonus: tips for Democrats. 1. Be sure your primaries include lots of candidates who will never be the nominee. Congressmen, businessmen, and inspirational individuals who have never held elective office. You don't want your base getting too focused on the actual purpose of the exercise. 2. Hold 312 primary debates. We Republicans find that having lots of debates encourages professional attention seekers to throw their hats in the ring. 3. Extend your primaries through July, or at least June, especially when running against an incumbent. It really keeps the nominee on his toes to have only 3 months to challenge a candidate who's been campaigning for 4 years. If the GOP is this stupid, it deserves to die. June 12, 2013. Democrats terrify Hispanics into thinking they'll be lynched if they vote for Republicans, and then turn around and taunt Republicans for not winning a majority of the Hispanic vote. This line of attack has real resonance with our stupidest Republicans, proposed Republican primary targets, Senators Kelly Ayotte, Jeff Flake, Lindsey Graham, and Marco Rubio, which explains why Republicans are devoting all their energy to slightly increasing their share of the Hispanic vote while alienating everyone else in America. It must be fun for liberals to manipulate Republicans into focusing on hopeless causes. Why don't Democrats waste their time trying to win the votes of gun owners? As journalist Steve Saylor recently pointed out, the Hispanic vote terrifying Republicans isn't that big. It actually declined in 2012. The Census Bureau finally released the real voter turnout numbers from the last election, and the Hispanic vote came in at only 8.4% of the electorate, not the 10% claimed by the pro-amnesty crowd. The sleeping giant of the last election wasn't Hispanics. It was elderly black women, terrified of media claims that Republicans were trying to suppress the black vote and determined to keep the first African-American president in the White House. Contrary to everyone's expectations, 10% more blacks voted in 2012 compared to 2008, even beating white voters, the usual turnout champions. Eligible black voters turned out at a rate of 66.2%, compared to 64.1% of eligible white voters. Only 48% of all eligible Hispanic voters went to the polls. No one saw the huge increase in black turnout coming, which is probably why Gallup had Romney up by 5 points before Hurricane Sandy hit, and still up by 1 point in its last pre-election poll after the hurricane. Only two groups voted in larger numbers in 2012 compared to 2008, blacks aged 45 to 64 and blacks over the age of 65, most elderly black women. In raw numbers, nearly twice as many blacks voted as Hispanics, 9 times as many whites voted as Hispanics, 98 million whites, 18 million blacks, and 11 million Hispanics. As Byron York has shown, even if Mitt Romney had won 70% of the Hispanic vote, he still would have lost. Keep in mind that no Republican presidential candidate in at least 50 years has won as much as half the Hispanic vote. In the presidential election immediately after Reagan signed an amnesty bill in 1986, the Republican share of the Hispanic vote plummeted from 37% to 30%. And that was in a landslide election for the GOP. Combined, the two Bush presidents averaged 32.5% of the Hispanic vote, and they have Hispanics in their family Christmas cards. John McCain, the the nation's leading amnesty proponent, won only 31% of the Hispanic vote, not much more than anti-amnesty Romney's 27%. So naturally, the Republican Party's entire battle plan going forward is to win slightly more votes from 8.4% of the electorate by giving them something they don't want. The pro-amnesty Pew Research Hispanic Center has produced poll after poll showing that Hispanics don't care about amnesty. In a poll last fall, Hispanic voters said they cared more about education, jobs, and health care than immigration. They even care more about the federal budget deficit than immigration. To put that in perspective, the next item on their list of concerns was scratchy towels. Also, note that Pew asked about immigration, not amnesty. Those Hispanics who said they cared about immigration might care about it the way I care about it, by supporting a fence and E-Verify. Amnesty is a gift to employers, not employees. Who convinced Republicans that Hispanics' wages aren't low enough and what they really need is an influx of low-wage workers competing for their jobs? Maybe the greedy businessmen now running the Republican Party should talk with their Hispanic maids sometime. Ask Juanita if she'd like to have 7 new immigrants competing with her for the opportunity to clean other people's houses, so that her wages can be dropped from $20 an hour to $10 an hour. A wise Latina, A.J. Delgado, recently explained on Mediaite.com why amnesty won't win Republicans the Hispanic vote, even if they get credit for it. Her very first argument was, Latinos will resent the added competition for jobs. But rich businessmen don't care. Big Republican donors and their campaign consultants just want to make money. They don't care about Hispanics, and they certainly don't care what happens to the country. If the country is hurt, I don't care as long as I am doing better. This is the very definition of treason. Hispanic voters are a small portion of the electorate. They don't want amnesty, and they're hopeless Democrats. So Republicans have decided the path to victory is to flood the country with lots more of them. It's as if Republicans convinced Democrats to fixate on banning birth control to win more pro-life voters. This would be great for Republicans because Democrats will never win a majority of pro-life voters, and about as many pro-lifers care about birth control as Hispanics care about amnesty. But that still wouldn't be as idiotic as what Republicans are doing because, according to Gallup, pro-lifers are nearly half of the electorate. Hispanics are only 8.4% of the electorate. And it still wouldn't be as stupid as the GOP pushing amnesty because banning birth control wouldn't create millions more voters who consistently vote against the Democrats. Listening to Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus burble a few weeks ago on Fox News Sunday about how amnesty is going to push the Republicans to new electoral heights, one is reminded of Democratic pollster Pat Caddell's reason for refusing to become a Republican. No matter how enraged he gets at Democratic corruption, he says he can't bear to join such a stupid party as the GOP. I got 30 million reasons. July 3rd, 2013. We keep hearing insistent claims that if Republicans don't pass amnesty yesterday, it will be the end of the party. Can I see the math on that? I can see why bringing in 30 million new Democratic voters would be good for the Democrats. But how does it help Republicans? Maybe conservatives shouldn't blindly trust the calculations of the guy who graduated fifth from the bottom of his class at the U.S. Naval Academy, John McCain. If I were a Democrat, I would have tried to sneak this bill past Republicans by proposing amnesty only after reaching some easily rigged benchmarks. But apparently, Chuck Schumer knows elected Republicans better than I do. Step 1, everyone's amnestied. Step 2, after they're amnestied, they can bring in all their relatives. If Hispanics voted 50.1% for Democrats, amnesty would be a bad deal for Republicans. But in fact, they vote 70% to 80% for Democrats. How did it become an urgent priority for Republicans to bring in 30 million new voters, 80% of whom will vote Democratic? Democrats want 30 million new voters, and they will say anything to get there. It's a crisis. Illegal immigrants are living in the shadows. That is not a crisis. At most, and this is highly dubious, it's a crisis for the illegal immigrants. But evidently, living in the shadows is at least better than living in Guadalajara. Otherwise, there's an easy solution. We're always told, you don't know what it's like to live in the shadows. Yes, you're right. And that proves it's not a crisis. Sorry to sound legalistic, illegal aliens, but you broke the law. And, look me in the eye, you know you broke the law. You hid in the backs of trucks, traveled across remote desert locations, ran from U.S. agents, and stole American IDs. It's supposed to be uncomfortable to break the law. We aren't required to grant amnesty to people just because they put themselves in the awkward position of being here illegally, or because the Democrats need 30 million new voters. If illegals were Republicans, Chuck Schumer would be a Minuteman patrolling the Mexican border 24/7. Oh boy, are Hispanics ever going to take revenge on Republicans? The obvious retort is, if these people vote 80% against Republicans, how does it hurt Republicans if they can't vote? Is the claim that next time legal Hispanics vote against you, they'll have an angry glint in their eye? Voting machines don't register angry glints. How could any decent person be against granting amnesty to lawbreakers? In common parlance, the decent thing to do is usually defined as following the law. The fact that Democrats want 30 million new voters is not a good enough reason to ignore the law and screw over the millions of people who have been waiting 20 years to come here legally. We already have de facto amnesty. I gather Marco Rubio considers this his big showstopper, since he says it in every interview as if he's announcing the Cochin-Specker theorem. But if we already have de facto amnesty, why is this bill even necessary? Oh, that's right. The Democrats need 30 million new voters. It's curious that Democrats don't hysterically demand amnesty for other lawbreakers, such as tax cheats or polluters. Right now, hold on to your hat, Marco. We have de facto amnesty for tax cheats and polluters. Also rapists and murderers and every other crime that doesn't have 100% enforcement. And if we won't grant amnesty to tax cheats and polluters, what about their children? Why punish the children? They did nothing wrong. Their parents told them they had lots of money for houses, clothes, and college tuition. How can you put a tax lien on the homes of innocent children? Think of how BP executives' children have suffered. The divorces, the deferred dreams, the broken families. And by the way, polluters are also hard workers. They love their families and want the best for them, too. I bet illegal aliens who rape women and kill people in drunk driving accidents love their families. Members of MS-13 work very hard at gang activities, such as, for example, when you cross them, they are very dogged about having you killed in a drive-by shooting. That shows a real stick-to-itiveness. But weirdly, Democrats are obsessed with amnesty only for the lawbreakers that will get them 30 million new voters. Violent felons come next. Republicans don't have to be brave to vote against amnesty. They need to not be idiots. This isn't a single issue. It's every issue. Presidential elections are decided by a few million votes. Giving the Democrats 30 million new voters means Republicans lose on everything. Obamacare, taxes, public sector unions, big government, abortion, gay marriage, racial preferences, and on and on and on. In another few years, the whole country will be California, and no Republican will win another national election. Maybe New Jersey Governor Chris Christie supports amnesty, as he did via his appointed senator, hoping to be the last Republican ever elected president. There's one for the history books. But if Christie says he's pro-life while giving the Democrats 30 million new voters, he's a liar. Hispanics favor abortion by 66%, compared to 50% of other voters. If he says he opposes Obamacare, court-mandated gay marriage, wants small government, and loves his country while voting to give the Democrats 30 million new voters, he's a liar. Hispanics support Obamacare by 62%, gay marriage by 59%, and big government by 75%. If he says he opposes bloated, expensive, public sector unions, he's a liar. Look no farther than California for our future. Instead of the elites bringing in another flood of low-wage immigrants to clean their homes and manicure their lawns and vote Democrat, how about we start getting some immigrants to compete with Florida senators and New Jersey governors? America nears El Tipping Pointo, December 5th, 2012. I apologize to America's young people, whose dashed dreams and dim employment prospects I had laughed at, believing these to be a direct result of their voting for Obama. On closer examination, it turns out that young voters, aged 18 to 29, overwhelmingly supported Romney, but only the white ones. According to Pew Research, 54% of white voters under 30 voted for Romney, and only 41% for Obama. That's the same percentage Reagan got from the entire white population in 1980. Even the Lena Dunham demographic, white women under 30, favored Romney. Reagan got just 43% of young voters in 1980, and that was when whites were 88% of the electorate. Only 58% of today's under 30 vote is white, and it's shrinking daily. What the youth vote shows is not that young people are nitwits who deserve lives of misery and joblessness, as I had previously believed, but that America is hitting the tipping point on our immigration policy. The youth vote is a snapshot of elections to come, if nothing is done to reverse the deluge of unskilled immigrants pouring into the country as a result of Ted Kennedy's 1965 Immigration Act. 85% of legal immigrants since 1968 have come from the Third World. A majority of them are in need of government assistance. Whites are 76% of the electorate over the age of 30, and only 58% of the electorate under 30. Obama won the youth vote because it is the knife's edge of a demographic shift, not because he offered the kids free contraception, which they don't need anyway, because it's hard to have sex when you're living with your parents at 27. In 1980, Hispanics were only 2% of the population, and they tended to be educated, skilled workers who got married, raised their children in two-parent families, and sent their kids to college before they, too, got married and had kids, in that order. That profile has nothing to do with recent Hispanic immigrants who, because of the phony family reunification rules, are the poorest of the world's poor. More than half of all babies born to Hispanic women today are illegitimate. As Heather McDonald has shown, the birth rate of Hispanic women is twice that of the rest of the population. Their unwed birth rate is 1.5 times that of blacks. That's a lot of government dependence coming down the pike. No amount of reaching out to the Hispanic community, effective messaging, or Reagan's optimism is going to turn Mexico's underclass into Republicans. Any election analysis that doesn't deal with the implacable fact of America's changing demographics is bound to be wrong. Perhaps the reason elections maven Michael Barone was so shockingly off in his election prediction this year was that, in the biggest mistake of his career, Barone has been assuring us for years that most of these third-world immigrants pouring into the country would go the way of Italian immigrants and become Republicans. They're hard-working. They have family values. Maybe at first, but not after coming here, having illegitimate children and going on welfare. Charles Murray recently pointed out that, contrary to stereotype, Hispanics are less likely to be married, less likely to go to church, more supportive of gay marriage, and less likely to call themselves conservative than other Americans. Rather than being more hard-working than Americans, Hispanics actually work about the same as others or, in the case of Hispanic women, less. It seems otherwise, Murray says, because the only Hispanics we see are the ones who are working, in our homes, neighborhoods, and businesses. That's the way that almost all Anglos in the political chattering class come in contact with Latinos. He notes, of course they look like model Americans. Black males would apparently like to work more. Nearly 20% of black males under 30 voted for Romney, more than three times what McCain got. An article by Nate Cohn in the current New Republic argues, as the title puts it, the GOP has problems with white voters too. As proof, Cohn cites Jefferson County, Colorado, Loudoun County, Virginia, Wake County, North Carolina, and Somerset County, New Jersey, all of which went Republican in presidential elections from 1968 through 2004, but which Romney lost in 2012. Smelling a rat, I checked the demographic shifts in these counties from the 2000 to the 2010 census. In each one, there has been a noticeable influx of Hispanics and Asians who also vote Democrat, diminishing the white vote that Cohn claims Republicans are losing. Between the 2000 and 2010 census, for example, the white population of Jefferson County declined from more than 90% to the high 70s, while the Hispanic population more than doubled, from 6% to 14%. In Loudoun County, whites plummeted from 83% to 69% of the population. Meanwhile, the Asian population tripled, from 5% to 15%, and the Hispanic population doubled from 6% to 12%. Similarly, Wake County shifted from 74% white to 66% white in the past decade, while the Hispanic population doubled, from 5% to 10%, and the black population stayed even at about 20%. Somerset County is now just 62% white, while the Hispanic population grew by 63% and the Asian population grew by 83% since 2000. These were the counties chosen by Cohn, not me, to show that Republicans are losing the white vote. Except they're not so white anymore, with blacks, Asians, and Hispanics block voting 93%, 73%, and 71% for Obama. Republicans have to do more than just win a majority of the white vote. They have to run the table. Romney got a larger percentage of the white vote than Reagan did in 1980. That's just not enough anymore. Ironically, Romney was the first Republican presidential candidate in a long time not conspiring with the elites to make America a dumping ground for the world's welfare cases. Conservatives who denounced Romney as a rhino were the ones doing the bidding of the real establishment, the soulless rich, who want cheap labor and couldn't care less if America ceases to be the land of opportunity that everyone wanted to immigrate to in the first place. 49 million to 5. June 3, 2009. Responding to the shooting death of late-term abortionist George Tiller, President Obama sent out a welcome message that this nation would not tolerate attacks on pro-lifers or any other Americans because of their religion or beliefs. Haha, just kidding. That was the lead sentence, with minor edits, of a New York Times editorial warning about the theoretical hate crimes against Muslims 8 months after 9/11. Why can't pro-lifers get the same oceans of ink devoted to assuring Americans that most pro-lifers are peaceful? For years, we've had to hear about the danger that Americans might overreact to a terrorist attack committed by 19 Muslims shouting Allahu Akbar as they flew commercial jets into American skyscrapers. We've never had a dozen pro-lifers shouting abortion kills a beating heart as they gunned down thousands of innocent citizens in Wichita, Kansas. Why aren't liberals rushing to assure us that most pro-lifers are peaceful? Unlike Muslims, pro-lifers actually are peaceful. According to recent polling, a majority of Americans oppose abortion, a fact implicitly acknowledged by liberals' refusal to let us vote on the subject. In a country with approximately 150 million pro-lifers, five abortionists have been killed since Roe v. Wade. In that same 36 years, more than 49 million babies have been killed in the womb. Let's recap that halftime score, sports fans, 49 million to 5. Meanwhile, fewer than 2 million Muslims live in America, and while Muslims are less murderous than abortionists, I'm fairly certain they've killed more than 5 people in the United States in the last 36 years. For some reason, The number 3,000 keeps popping into my head. So in a country that is more than 50% pro-life and 80% opposed to the late-term abortions of the sort performed by Tiller, only 5 abortionists have been killed. And in a country that is less than 0.5% Muslim, Muslims have killed thousands of Americans. But the killing of about 1 abortionist per decade leads liberals to condemn the entire pro-life movement as domestic terrorists. Tiller bragged about performing 60,000 abortions, including abortions of viable babies, able to survive outside their mother's womb. He made millions of dollars performing late-term abortions so gruesome that, in the entire country, only 2 other abortionists, not a squeamish bunch, would perform them. Kansas law allows late-term abortions only to save the mother's life or to prevent irreversible physical damage to the mother. But Tiller was more than happy to kill viable babies, provided the mothers, 1, forked over $5,000, and 2, mentioned substantial and irreversible conditions, which, in Tiller's view, included not being able to go to concerts or rodeos, or being temporarily depressed on account of their pregnancies. In return for blood money from Tiller's abattoir, Democrats ran a political protection racket for the late-term abortionist. In 1997, The Washington Post reported that Tiller attended one of Bill Clinton's White House coffees for major campaign contributors. In addition to a $25,000 donation to Clinton, Tiller wanted to thank him personally for 30 months of U.S. Marshals protection paid for by the U.S. taxpayer. Kansas Democrats, who received hundreds of thousands of campaign dollars from Tiller, repeatedly intervened to block any interference with Tiller's abortion mill. Kathleen Sebelius, the governor of Kansas until Obama made her Health and Human Services secretary, received 6-figure donations from Tiller. She vetoed one bill restricting late-term abortions and another one that would have required Tiller to turn over his records pertaining to substantial and irreversible conditions justifying his late-term abortions. Kansas Attorney General Paul Morrison also got elected with the help of Tiller's blood money, replacing a Republican attorney general who was in the middle of an investigation of Tiller for various crimes, including his failure to report statutory rapes, despite performing abortions on girls as young as 11. But soon after Morrison replaced the Republican attorney general, the charges against Tiller were reduced and, in short order, he was acquitted of a few misdemeanors. In what is a not uncommon occurrence with Democrats, Morrison is now gone, having been forced to resign when his mistress charged him with sexual harassment and corruption. Tiller was protected not only by a Praetorian guard of elected Democrats, but also by the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, coincidentally the same church attended by Tiller's fellow Wichita executioner, the BTK killer. The official web page of the ELCA instructs, "A developing life in the womb does not have an absolute right to be born." As long as we're deciding who does and doesn't have an absolute right to be born, who's to say late-term abortionists have an absolute right to live? I wouldn't kill an abortionist myself, but I wouldn't want to impose my moral values on others. No one is for shooting abortionists. But how will criminalizing those who make the difficult, often tragic, decision to shoot an abortionist be an effective means of reducing the shootings of abortionists? Following the moral logic of liberals, I say, if you don't believe in shooting abortionists, then don't shoot one. The biggest scandal in U.S. history. June 27, 2012. Forget executive privilege, contempt of Congress, fast and furious, how many documents the government has produced, and who said what to whom on which date. The Obama administration has almost certainly engaged in the most shockingly vile corruption scandal in the history of the country, not counting the results of Season 8 on American Idol. Administration officials intentionally put guns into the hands of Mexican drug cartels so that, when the guns taken from Mexican crime scenes turned out to be American guns, Democrats would have a reason to crack down on gun sellers in the United States. Democrats will never stop trying to take our guns away. They see something more lethal than a salad shooter and wet themselves. But since their party was thrown out of Congress for the first time in nearly half a century as a result of passing the 1994 assault weapons ban, even liberals knew they were going to need a really good argument to pass any limitation on guns ever again. So it's curious that Democrats all started telling the same lie about guns as soon as Obama became president. In March 2009, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced to reporters on a trip to Mexico, "Since we know that the vast majority, 90%, of that weaponry, used by Mexican drug cartels, comes from our country, we are going to try to stop it from getting there in the first place." As she sentimentally elaborated on Fox News's On the Record with Greta Van Susteren, "The guns sold in the United States, which are illegal in Mexico, get smuggled and shipped across our border and arm these terrible drug-dealing criminals so that they can outgun these poor police officers along the border and elsewhere in Mexico." Suddenly that 90% statistic was everywhere. It was like the fake statistic about the number of women beaten by their husbands on Super Bowl Sunday. CBS's Bob Schieffer asked Obama on Face the Nation, "It's my understanding that 90% of the guns that they're getting down in Mexico are coming from the United States. We don't seem to be doing a very good job of cutting off the gun flow. Do you need any kind of legislative help on that front? Have you, for example, thought about asking Congress to reinstate the ban on assault weapons?" At a Senate hearing, Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat, California, said, "It is unacceptable to have 90% of the guns that are picked up in Mexico and used to shoot judges, police officers, and mayors come from the United States." And then, thanks to Fox News, the first network to report it, we found out that the 90% figure was complete bunkum. It was a fabrication told by William Hoover of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, BATF, and then spread like wildfire by Democrats and the media. Mexican law enforcement authorities send only a fraction of the guns they recover from criminals back to the U.S. for tracing. Which guns do they send? The guns that have U.S. serial numbers on them. It would be like asking a library to produce all their Mark Twain books and then concluding that 100% of the books in that library are by Mark Twain. You begin to see why the left hates Fox News so much. Obama slowly backed away from the preposterous 90% claim. His National Security Council spokesman explained to Fox News that by recovered, they meant guns traceable to the United States. So in other words, Democrats were frantically citing the amazing fact that almost all guns traceable to the U.S. were traceable to the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder told reporters that even if the percentage is inaccurate, the vast majority of guns seized in crimes in Mexico come from the United States. And he should know he was sending them there. This was absurd. Most of the guns used by drug cartels are automatic weapons, not to mention shoulder-fired rockets that can't be sold to most Americans. They are acquired from places like Russia, China, and Guatemala. It seems that right about the time the 90% lie was unraveling, the Obama administration decided to give Mexican criminals thousands of American guns. Apart from the fact that tracking thousands of guns into Mexico is not feasible or rational, the guns dumped on Mexican criminal cartels didn't have GPS tracing devices on them anyway. There is no conceivable law enforcement objective to such a program. This is what we know. 1. Liberals thought it would be a great argument for gun control if American guns were ending up in the hands of Mexican criminals. 2. They wanted that to be true so badly, Democrats lied about it. 3. After they were busted on their lie, the Obama administration began placing thousands of American guns in the hands of Mexican criminals. We also know that hundreds of people were murdered with these U.S.-supplied guns, including at least one American, U.S. Border Patrol agent Brian Terry. But let's look at the bright side. The BATF was originally going to ship warheads to Iran until realizing the explosions might disable the tracking devices. Contrary to more Democrat lies, There was no program to dump thousands of guns in Mexico under George W. Bush. The Bush administration did have a program that put GPS trackers on about 100 guns in order to actually trace them. That operation was ended almost as soon as it began because of the lack of cooperation from Mexican officials. You may as well say Holder's program was started by the first cop who ever put tracer dye on any contraband. No one has explained what putting 2,500 untraceable guns in the hands of Mexican drug dealers was supposed to accomplish. But you know what it might have accomplished? It would make the Democrats' 90% lie retroactively true, allowing them to push for the same gun restrictions they were planning when they first concocted that lie. A majority of guns recovered from Mexican criminals would at last be American guns, but only because Eric Holder had put them there. Unfortunately for the Democrats, some brave whistleblower inside the government leaked details of this monstrous scheme. As soon as Congress and the public demanded answers, Holder clammed up. He just says, whoops, and accuses Republicans of racism. Guns don't kill people. The mentally ill do. January 16, 2013. Sung-hui Cho, who committed the Virginia Tech massacre in 2007, had been diagnosed with severe anxiety disorder as a child and placed under treatment. Virginia Tech was prohibited from being told about Cho's mental health problems because of federal privacy laws. At college, Cho engaged in behavior even more bizarre than the average college student. He stalked three women and, at one point, went totally silent, refusing to speak even to his roommates. He was involuntarily committed to a mental institution for one night and then unaccountably unleashed on the public, whereupon he proceeded to engage in the deadliest mass shooting by an individual in U.S. history. The 2011 Tucson, Arizona shopping mall shooter, Jared Loughner, was so obviously disturbed that if he'd stayed in Pima Community College long enough to make the yearbook, he would have been named most likely to commit mass murder. After Loughner got a tattoo, the artist, Carl Grace, remarked, "That's a weird dude. That's a Columbine candidate." One of Loughner's teachers, Ben McGahey, filed numerous complaints against him, hoping to have him removed from class. "When I turned my back to write on the board," McGahey said, "I would always turn back quickly to see if he had a gun." On her first day at school, student Linda Sorensen emailed her friends about Loughner. "We do have one student in the class who was disruptive today. I'm not certain yet if he was on drugs, as one person surmised, or disturbed. He scares me a bit. The teacher tried to throw him out, and he refused to go, so I talked to the teacher afterward. Hopefully he will be out of class very soon and not come back with an automatic weapon." The last of several emails Sorensen sent about Loughner said, "We have a mentally unstable person in the class that scares the living sea out of me. He is one of those whose picture you see on the news after he has come into class with an automatic weapon. Everyone interviewed would say, 'Yeah, he was in my math class and he was really weird.'" That was the summer before Loughner killed six people at the Tucson shopping mall, including a Republican-appointed federal judge and a nine-year-old girl, and critically wounded Representative Gabrielle Giffords, among others. Loughner had run-ins with the law, including one charge for possessing drug paraphernalia, a lethal combination with mental illness. He was eventually asked to leave college on mental health grounds, released on the public without warning. Perhaps if Carl Grace, Ben McGahey, or Linda Sorensen worked in the mental health field, six people wouldn't have had to die that January morning in Tucson. But committing Loughner to a mental institution in Arizona would have required a court order stating that he was a danger to himself and others. Innumerable studies have found a correlation between severe mental illness and violent behavior. 31% to 61% of all homicides committed by disturbed individuals occur during their first psychotic episode. That's why mass murderers often have no criminal record. There's no time to wait with the mentally ill. James Holmes, the accused Aurora, Colorado shooter, was under psychiatric care at the University of Colorado long before he shot up a movie theater. According to news reports and court filings, Holmes told his psychiatrist, Dr. Lynn Fenton, that he fantasized about killing a lot of people. But she refused law enforcement's offer to place Holmes under confinement for 72 hours. However, Fenton did drop Holmes as a patient after he made threats against another school psychiatrist. And after Holmes made threats against a professor, he was asked to leave campus. But he wasn't committed. People who knew he was deeply troubled just pushed him onto society to cause havoc elsewhere. Little is known so far about Adam Lanza, the alleged Newtown, Connecticut elementary school shooter. But anyone who could shoot a terrified child and say to himself, "That was fun, I think I'll do it 20 more times," is not all there. It has been reported that Lanza's mother, his first victim, was trying to have him involuntarily committed to a mental institution, triggering his rage. If true, and the media seemed remarkably uninterested in finding out if it is true, Mrs. Lanza would have had to undergo a long and grueling process, unlikely to succeed. As the New York Times' Joe Nocera recently wrote, Connecticut's laws are so restrictive in terms of the proof required to get someone committed that Adam Lanza's mother would probably not have been able to get him help even if she had tried. Taking guns away from law-abiding citizens without mental illnesses will do nothing about the Cho's, Loeffner's, Holmes's, or Lanza's. Such people have to be separated from civil society, for the public's sake as well as their own. But this is nearly impossible, because the ACLU has decided that being psychotic is a civil right. Consequently, whenever a psychopath with a million gigantic warning signs commits a shocking murder, the knee-jerk reaction is to place yet more controls on guns. By now, guns are the most heavily regulated product in America. It hasn't worked. Even if it could work, and it can't, there are still subway tracks, machetes, fists, and bombs. The most deadly massacre at a school in U.S. history was at an elementary school in Michigan in 1927. It was committed with a bomb by a mentally disturbed man. How about trying something new for a change? Chapter 11. Guns and Crime. Guns do kill people. Thank God. Every liberal argument about crime employs the same trick. Liberals will cite a statistic designed to create a specific image in your head, when the reality is something entirely different. For example, they'll say, a gun in the home is X times more likely to kill you than to kill an intruder. Also confidence-inspiring, the exact number is constantly changing. You're supposed to imagine some bumbling homeowner who thinks he's a hotshot with a gun, having it snatched away from him by a criminal. That never happens. Or, to be precise, criminals wrest guns from their owners in less than 1% of all defensive gun uses, according to criminologist Gary Kleck. The principal way guns in the home kill the gun owner is by suicide, but there is no evidence that the presence of a gun increases the likelihood of suicide. More importantly, suicide is not what we were picturing when liberals told us guns are more likely to be used to kill their owners than an intruder. And then you also notice, why does the intruder have to be killed? Couldn't you just wing him? Couldn't you hold him at gunpoint until the police arrive? He might see the error of his ways, clean up, and go to Harvard Law School. By requiring that the attacker be killed, liberals have excluded 99% of cases where a gun is used to stop a criminal. Similarly, liberals say murderers are X times more likely to get the death penalty when their victims are white than when the victim is black. Hearing that, most people imagine white racists across the land not caring when black people are murdered. The truth is nearly the opposite. That statistic merely reflects the fact that whites are more likely to get the death penalty than blacks. A 2004 study by Cornell Law professors John Bloom, Theodore Eisenberg, and Martin T. Wells found that, from 1976 to 1998, blacks committed 51.5% of all murders in the U.S., but were only 41.3% of those sentenced to death from 1977 to 1999. The majority of black murder victims are killed by other blacks, and most white murder victims are killed by whites. So looking at the race of the victims is just another way of looking at the race of the murderer. Death sentences are more likely when the victim is white only because their murderers are usually white, and whites are more likely to receive capital sentences. One of the main reasons black murderers are less likely to get the death penalty than white murderers is that black-on-black killings tend to occur in places with large black populations. Black juries, it turns out, are far less likely than whites to vote for the death penalty. But the fact that blacks resist imposing capital sentences on other blacks is not the image created by the statement that the death penalty is more likely to be imposed when the victim is white. Another good one is the claim that more than three women are murdered by their husbands or intimate partners in this country every day. The important phrase in that sentence is intimate partners. Always look for intimate partners in the domestic abuse statistics. It's like saying 89 people are killed every day by puppies or cars. Can we separate out the puppies? There's a cottage industry in putting out statistics that combine things that are not at all alike. Every 11 seconds a woman in this country is raped, murdered, beaten, made fun of, not appreciated for her work, or told to talk more quietly. In 2010, a high water mark for connubial murder, two women per thousand were killed by actual live-in husbands, according to the Department of Justice Bureau of Justice Statistics. Another 59.6 were killed by husbands from whom they were separated. Eight were killed by their boyfriends or lovers. 6.5 per thousand were killed by ex-husbands, and that year was unusually low for partner murders. In 2000, more than 116 women were killed by intimate partners, whom they were not married to and living with. Less than 2 per thousand were killed by their live-in husbands. Liberal crime statistics are like those spot-the-difference puzzles, where you examine two pictures to find some minor discrepancy, like a missing hair ribbon. You have to really scrutinize their statements to notice the sleight of hand involved. One bogus study that made the rounds after the Newtown, Connecticut shooting claimed that not a single public shooting in the last 30 years had been stopped by a civilian using a gun. Then you find out the reputable economist set Mother Jones magazine had that conclusion baked in the cake. Their study included only public shootings where at least 4 people were killed. In other words, cases in which the shooter was not stopped. It's like saying, in order to prove that water does not prevent dehydration, we looked every case in the last 30 years where someone died of thirst. In not one of those cases was water used to prevent dehydration. Try drinking water next time. By now, anyone who wants the truth knows that economist John Lott's studies prove beyond cavil that the only public policy to reduce casualties from public shootings are concealed carry laws. With the cat out of the bag on that one, the left's only retort is to neurotically refer to Lott as discredited. In liberal lingo, discredited means ignore this study. It didn't come out well for us. Sometimes word games won't do the trick, and liberals are forced to lie outright. This was their approach with Troy Davis, a blindingly guilty cop killer finally executed in 2011. As Davis's execution date approached, MSNBC and CNN provided urgent, around-the-clock coverage, confidently asserting that Davis was absolutely innocent. 7 of 9 witnesses against him had recanted their testimony, or so they claimed. Now, 2 years later, after everyone has forgotten the details, Aaron Sorkin gets worked up about the case and writes a 2013 newsroom episode repeating all the lies about the case. He deliberately used real names and real events to create this notion in people's minds. Wow, 7 out of 9 witnesses recanted. Troy Davis was innocent. As set forth in the column, there weren't 9 witnesses against Davis. There were 34. And this will give you an idea of what liberals meant by recanted. One such recantation was from Harriet Murray, the girlfriend of the homeless man Larry Young, whom Davis was pistol-whipping when Officer McPhail ordered him to stop, provoking Davis to murder McPhail in a Burger King parking lot full of witnesses. Ms. Murray was sitting outside the restaurant, watching the whole melee. At trial, she identified Davis as the man in the white shirt. Numerous witnesses testified that the officer's murderer was wearing a white shirt, who pistol-whipped her boyfriend and then pumped bullets into Officer McPhail. In her recantation, Ms. Murray recanted none of that. In fact, she repeated it. But the defense lawyer who drafted her affidavit slipped in the additional fact that the man who pistol-whipped her boyfriend and shot the police officer was arguing with Larry. Other trial testimony indicated that the shooter had not argued with the homeless man before striking him. But as the court noted, this was such a minor variation from her original testimony, she may not have even realized it was different from what she had said at trial many years earlier. Nothing in the affidavit stated that she was recanting any of her testimony or that she had lied. She did not consider the affidavit important enough even to give Davis's lawyer time to notarize it. The affidavit was another spot-the-difference game, this time intended to fool a witness. That's not a recantation. It's a sneaky trick. Negroes with Guns, April 18th, 2012. Liberals have leapt on the shooting death of Trayvon Martin in Florida to push for the repeal of stand-your-ground laws and to demand tighter gun control. MSNBC's Karen Finney blamed the same people who stymied gun regulation at every point. This would be like demanding more funding for the General Services Administration after seeing how its employees blew taxpayer money on a party weekend in Las Vegas. We don't know the facts yet, but let's assume the conclusion MSNBC is leaping to is accurate. George Zimmerman stalked a small black child and murdered him in cold blood just because he was black. If that were true, every black person in America should get a gun and join the National Rifle Association, America's oldest and most august civil rights organization. Apparently this has occurred to no one because our excellent public education system ensures that no American under the age of 60 has the slightest notion of this country's history. Gun control laws were originally promulgated by Democrats to keep guns out of the hands of blacks. This allowed the Democratic policy of slavery to proceed with fewer bumps and, after the Civil War, allowed the Democratic Ku Klux Klan to menace and murder black Americans with little resistance. Contrary to what illiterates believe, the KKK was an outgrowth of the Democratic Party, with overlapping membership roles. The Klan was to the Democrats what the American Civil Liberties Union is today. Not every Democrat is an ACLUer, but every ACLUer is a Democrat. Same with the Klan. In 1640, the very first gun control law ever enacted on these shores was passed in Virginia. It provided that blacks, even freemen, could not own guns. Chief Justice Roger Taney's infamous opinion in Dred Scott v. Sanford circularly argued that blacks could not be citizens because if they were citizens, they would have the right to own guns. It would give them the full liberty, he said, to keep and carry arms wherever they went. Dealing with logic like that, Republicans eventually had to fight a civil war to get the Democrats to give up slavery. Alas, they were Democrats, so they couldn't learn. After the war, Democratic legislators enacted black codes denying black Americans the rights of citizenship, such as the rather crucial one of bearing arms, while other Democrats, sometimes the same Democrats, founded the Ku Klux Klan. For more than 100 years, Republicans have aggressively supported arming blacks so they could defend themselves against Democrats. The original draft of the Anti-Klan Act of 1871, passed at the urging of Republican President Ulysses S. Grant, made it a federal felony to deprive any citizen of the United States of any arms or weapons he may have in his house or possession for the defense of his person, family, or property. This section was deleted from the final bill only because it was deemed both beyond Congress's authority and superfluous, inasmuch as the rights of citizenship included the right to bear arms. Under authority of the Anti-Klan Act, President Grant deployed the U.S. military to destroy the Klan and pretty nearly completed the job. But the Klan had a few resurgences in the early and mid-20th century. Curiously, wherever the Klan became a political force, gun control laws would suddenly appear on the books. This will give you an idea of how gun control laws worked. Following the firebombing of his house in 1956, Dr. Martin Luther King, who was, among other things, a Christian minister, applied for a gun permit. But the Alabama authorities found him unsuitable. A decade later, he won a Nobel Peace Prize. How's that may-issue gun permit policy working for you? The NRA opposed these discretionary gun permit laws and proceeded to grant NRA charters to blacks who sought to defend themselves from Klan violence, including the great civil rights hero Robert F. Williams. A World War II Marine veteran, Williams returned home to Monroe, North Carolina, to find the Klan riding high, beating, lynching, and murdering blacks at will. No one would join the NAACP for fear of Klan reprisals. Williams became president of the local chapter and increased membership from 6 to more than 200. But it was not until he got a charter from the NRA in 1957 and founded the Black Armed Guard that the Klan got their comeuppance in Monroe. Williams's repeated thwarting of violent Klan attacks is described in his stirring book, Negroes with Guns. In one crucial battle, the Klan besieged the home of a black physician and his wife. But Williams and his black armed guard stood sentry and repelled the larger, cowardly force. And that was the end of it. As the Klan found out, it's not so much fun when the rabbits got the gun. The NRA's proud history of fighting the Klan has been airbrushed out of the record by those who were complicit with the KKK, which is to say, the Democrats. In the preface to Negroes with Guns, Williams writes, "I have asserted the right of Negroes to meet the violence of the Ku Klux Klan by armed self-defense and have acted on it. It has always been an accepted right of Americans, as the history of our western states proves, that where the law is unable or unwilling to enforce order, the citizens can and must act in self-defense against lawless violence. Contrary to MSNBC hosts, I do not believe the shooting in Florida is evidence of a resurgent KKK. But wherever the truth lies in that case, gun control is always a scheme of the powerful to deprive the powerless of the right to self-defense." Murder spree by people who refuse to ask for directions. January 14, 2009. In a front-page article on January 2nd of this year, the New York Times took a brief respite from its ongoing canonization of Barack Obama and returned to its series on violent crimes committed by returning GIs, or, as I call it, U.S. military psycho killers. The Treason Times' series about Iraq and Afghanistan veterans accused of murder began in January last year, but was quickly discontinued as readers noticed that the Times doggedly refused to provide any statistics comparing veterans with any other group. So they waited a year, hoping readers wouldn't notice they were still including no relevant comparisons for the implicit claim that veterans are especially murderous. Forget comparing veteran murderers to the population at large. The germane comparison is between veterans and the general population of young males. The general population includes housewives, grandmothers, and little old men in nursing homes. But violent crime is committed almost exclusively by young men. Consequently, any group composed primarily of young men will contain a mammoth number of murderers compared to the entire population. Consider the harmless fantasy game Dungeons and Dragons. After a number of murders were committed in the 80s by Dungeons and Dragons enthusiasts, some people concluded the game led to murderous tendencies. Another explanation is that it's a game that happens to be played almost exclusively by young men. For its series about how America's brave enlisted men are really a bunch of psychopathic cutthroats, the Times triumphantly produced 121 homicides committed by veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Perhaps the Times' next major exposé could be on how a huge percentage of murderers are people who won't ask for directions or share the TV remote. Let's compare murders by veterans to murders by other 18 to 35-year-olds in the U.S. population at large. From 1976 to 2005, 18 to 24-year-olds, both male and more gentle females, committed homicide at a rate of 29.9 per 100,000. Since 9/11, about 1.6 million troops have served in either Iraq or Afghanistan. That makes the homicide rate among veterans of these wars 7.6 per 100,000, or about one-third the homicide rate for their age group, 18 to 35, in the general population of both sexes. But fewer than 200,000 of the 1.6 million troops who served in Iraq and Afghanistan have been women, and the murder rate for the general population includes both males and females. Inasmuch as males commit nearly 90% of all murders, the rate for males in those age groups is probably nearly double the male-female combined rates, which translates conservatively to about 35 to 55 murderers per 100,000 males aged 18 to 35. So comparing the veterans' murder rate to only their male counterparts in the general population, we see that Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are about 5 to 10 times less likely to commit a murder than non-veterans. But as long as the Times has such a burning interest in the root causes of murder, how about considering the one factor more likely to create a murderer than any other? That is the topic we're not allowed to discuss, single motherhood. As I describe in my new book, Guilty, Liberal Victims and Their Assault on America, controlling for socioeconomic status, race, and place of residence, the strongest predictor of whether a person will end up in prison is that he was raised by a single parent. The second strongest factor is owning a Denis Kucinich bumper sticker. By 1996, 70% of inmates in state juvenile detention centers serving long-term sentences were raised by single mothers. 70% of dropouts, suicides, runaways, teenage births, juvenile delinquents, and child murderers involve children raised by single mothers. Girls raised without fathers are more sexually promiscuous and more likely to end up divorced. A 1990 study by the left-wing Progressive Policy Institute showed that, after controlling for single motherhood, the difference in black and white crime disappeared. Various studies come up with slightly different numbers, but all the figures are grim. A study cited in the far left-wing Village Voice found that children brought up in single-mother homes are 5 times more likely to commit suicide, 9 times more likely to drop out of high school, 10 times more likely to abuse chemical substances, 14 times more likely to commit rape for the boys, 20 times more likely to end up in prison, and 32 times more likely to run away from home. With new children being born, running away, dropping out of high school, and committing murder every year, it's not a static problem to analyze. But however the numbers are run, single motherhood is a societal nuclear bomb. Even in liberals' fevered nightmares, predatory mortgage dealers, oil speculators, and Ken Lay could never do as much harm to their fellow human beings as single mothers do to their own children, to say nothing of society at large. Think I'm being cruel? Imagine an America with 60 to 70% fewer juvenile delinquents, teenage births, teenage suicides, and runaways, and you will appreciate what the sainted single mothers have accomplished. But the Times won't run that series because liberals cheer for the dissolution of traditional marriage in America. They detest the military, so they cite a few anecdotal examples of veterans who have committed murder and hope that no one asks for details.